Welcome, everybody. I invite you to finish taking your seats and get settled in as we prepare for our meeting. Welcome to the Fort Lauderdale Primary Purpose Big Book Study Group's Thursday night Alcoholics and God Speaker Step Series. Now let's have our joke from Mike Chase.
In honor of our Irishman tonight. An Englishman, an Irishman, a Scotsman, a Welshman, a Frenchman, a German, an Italian, and a Swede. Two Finns, a Norwegian, a Dane, a Greenlander, an Australian, a Hungarian, a Pole, a Lithuanian, a Lifton, an Estonian, a Russian, a Turk, an Egyptian, a Palestinian, an Israeli, a Greek, a Macedonian, a Moldovan, a Chinese guy, a Japanese guy, a Levitonian, a Vietnamese guy, a comedian, North Korean guy, a South Korean guy, an American in a Mexican outfit, a Canadian, a Brazilian, an Australian, and a New Zealander, a South African, and a Libyan, Moroccan, and a Spaniard, and a Cuban try to walk into a fancy cocktail bar. The bouncer says, "Sorry, lads, you can't come in without a tie."
Thank you, Mike Chase. I'm a recovered alcoholic. My name is Tanner. I would like to thank you all for joining us tonight. In a minute or two, we are going to start our two-minute meditation. So please take a moment to get situated. Please turn off all devices that make noise that might and will distract others. Take this time to get connected to God. Let the craziness of the day drift away and ask God to help you stay focused on the step study tonight. Is everybody ready? If so, let's start the meditation. Fog-like prayer. If you don't know it, it's on the screens to my left and right. God, let your love shine through me like a fog light so those who are lost, sick, and dying can find your love in me. Amen. There is a solution from the Big Book, page 17. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. And I've asked Cindy to read Spiritual Experience, Appendix 2. We read this because the main purpose of the 12 steps is to have one. Oh, no, you're fine. You can. We read this because the main purpose of the 12 steps is to have one. So it's kind of important to know what one is. Yeah.
There you go. You're welcome. Everybody, I'm Cindy Alcoholic. Spiritual experience. The term spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which upon careful reading shows that the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself among us in many different forms. Yet it is true that our first printing gave many readers the impression that these personality changes or religious experiences must be in the nature of sudden and spectacular upheavals. Happily for everyone, this conclusion is erroneous. In the first few chapters, a number of sudden revolutionary changes are described. Though it was not our intention to create such an impression, many alcoholics have nevertheless concluded that in order to recover, they must acquire an immediate and overwhelming God consciousness, followed at once by a vast change in feeling and outlook. Among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformations, though frequent, are by no means the rule. Most of our experiences are what the psychologist William James calls the educational variety, because they develop slowly over a period of time. Quite often, friends of the newcomer are aware of the difference long before he is himself. He finally realizes that he has undergone a profound alteration in his reaction to life, that such a change could hardly have been brought about by himself alone. What often takes place in a few months could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. With few exceptions, our members find that they have tapped an unsuspected inner resource, which they presently identify with their own conception of power greater than themselves. Most of us think the awareness of a power greater than ourselves is the essence of spiritual experience. Our more religious members call it God consciousness. Most emphatically, we wish to say that any alcoholic capable of honestly facing this problem is the light of our experience can recover, provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable. there is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all argument, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation. Herbert Spencer, Alcoholics Anonymous, pages 567, 568.
Thank you. Thank you, Cindy. Please refrain from disturbing others by talking or constantly getting up and sitting back down. This is a tech-free meeting, so set your phones to airplane mode or just turn them off. Tonight we have Pat speaking. I've never heard him speak before. It's going to be a new experience for me, and hopefully everybody has their hearts and minds set on staying focused. So I'm very glad to hear what you have to say, Pat. Come on up.
You don't know how I feel. My theme song, Tom Petty, baby. Let me run with you tonight. I'll take you. Good stuff. You're going to have to cue that up better next time. Get to the chorus. That's my song. You don't know how I feel. You know? If you knew what it was like to be me, you wouldn't be here. We were talking about that before the meeting. You know, if I still feel a lot of fear when I speak, and I said, if you knew what I felt, you would have ran. You know, that's... I thought after like a couple years of speaking it would go away, but 28 years later, it hasn't gone away. But anyways, I'm a recovered alcoholic. My name is Pat. And thanks to the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous outlined in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the program of AA, I have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, and for that, I will be forever grateful. AA didn't just save my life, but it gave me one worth living, and I absolutely love my life today. You know, I don't know why lately I've been really nostalgic about when I first came in here and really focusing a lot about what I heard when I got into the meetings here when I first started coming to AA. And I remember specifically hearing a guy introduce himself similar to what I just did there. And then he said, I had a life beyond my wildest dreams. And I thought he was delusional. You know, I thought, like, I got to go up there and tell this guy where he is. You know, he's in an AA. I mean, how can a winner be in AA? I mean, like, you end up here. You know, I mean, that's right. I mean, it's not like I got up one morning and said, I got a good idea. I think I need a spiritual awakening. And I know this group of people who work this spiritual program of recovery, and I'm going to go there and get recovered. And it's just not the way it happens. You know, I don't wake up with a good idea and end up getting sober. You know? Most of us, our recovery is grounded in tragedy, you know, unfortunately, you know. And if you're new here, I mean, how many people we have new? Anybody new? Anybody under 30 days? Yeah, good. Welcome. I'm glad you're here, because usually coming here, I feel like I'm speaking to the choir, because, you know, a lot of these guys study the same people that I study, and, you know, we chase the same speakers that we both chase the same speakers. We're both Joe and Charlie fans, you know, and those were my idols. Those were, Charlie Parmalee was my mentor, and so most of my stuff comes from there. But it's good to hear somebody. It's good to have somebody here that hasn't heard me before. So at least somebody will think it's new shit, you know. But you come in here and that's what you hear, right? You hear somebody in AA say they have a life beyond their wildest dreams. And I don't even think the guy had a car or a girlfriend. You know what I mean? And because that's what we think, right? We're raised to live this ego-driven life where, you know, we're judged by things. Our success is judged by what we're driving, where we live, who's on our arm, what kind of watch we have. And that's the measure of success. And we're just kind of taught that. I don't know about you guys. I mean, maybe there's a few of you that your parents sat you down when you were very young and said, look, this is about spirituality, right? And really what you need to do is focus your whole life on living by spiritual principles. And if you do that, you're going to have a happy, successful life. I didn't hear that. You know, I heard that it, you know, if you get good grades, you're going to be successful. You know, if you, and what success meant was that you'll get a good job, you'll get good grades, you'll get, do well in school, and when you get out of school, you'll get a good job. Maybe you'll go to college, maybe you'll get a degree, or maybe you'll go to trade school, and you'll end up with a good job, and you'll make a lot of money, and you'll have a nice car, and you'll find a nice wife, and you're going to have a wonderful life. You know, and that's what I thought. That was the measure of success. And, you know, I know now that's an ego-driven life. That's not a spiritually driven life. But I learned that here. And so to hear somebody in AA who doesn't even have a girlfriend or a car say they had a life beyond their wildest dreams, I said, this guy's sick. I don't belong here. I don't belong here. And we hear stuff, you know, crazy shit, like surrender to win, you know, and, you know, you got to, you know, give it away to keep it, you know, you got to suffer to get well, and, you know, all the crazy stuff, right? Die to live, you know, just the opposite of what I believed when I got here. I mean, it was really crazy when I first got here. And look, I don't know about you guys when you first got here. I knew I needed to be here. That's true. I don't even know if I knew that when I got here, but I didn't want to be here. I did not want to. That was not on what I want to be when I grow up list. You know what I mean? I do not want to be. I didn't have written down, what do you want to do when you grow up? Well, you know, I want to have a nice job. I want to have a girlfriend and a nice car. And I want to be a key speaker at an AA meeting. You know, that was not on my list of things to do. It was not. And it's really not on my list of things to do now. But it's just been, you know, somehow we get chosen. I don't know how that happens. And you either answer the call or you don't. You know, I think we've all been chosen. I think everybody that's sitting here has been chosen. You just have, are you going to answer the call or not? You know, I think it's hilarious when I hear people say, you know, can't figure out what God's will for me. I just keep ending up in AA, you know. Well, there you go. You know, it's not rocket science. This is the fourth time you've landed in recovery. Guess where God wants you to be? Yeah. Helping other drunks probably, you know. But I didn't want to be here, and the truth is, when I got here, I didn't feel better. You know, I didn't. I mean, a lot of people say, you know, that they got better, they came in here and they felt better just being here. I didn't. I felt better. I felt fear better. I felt anger better. I felt anxiety better. You know, I didn't do well my first few months in AA. I suffered from don't drink and go to meetings. That's what I suffered from. And, I just for some reason lately, I've been reflecting back on that early AA. And it's interesting. I had a resentment a long time against AA because I sat here untreated for 3 months before anybody approached me. Like our book says, by the way, it doesn't mention sponsorship, but twice in chapter 2, it talks about being approached by the man with the answer. Twice it mentions being approached. It doesn't say anything about I asked somebody to sponsor me and they had the answer. That's not what it says. It says they saw a newcomer in a meeting. They went after that newcomer and they approached that man with the answer. And told them what they had found, supported them, laid that kid of spiritual tools at their feet, asking, are you ready? You know, but as our book says, these are drastic proposals, you know, and not all of us are. So I had kind of a resentment when I got here that I didn't hear the problem. I didn't hear it. You know, I fell in with the don't drink and go to Denny's crowd. That was our motto. That was our mantra. Don't drink and go to Denny's. Kim was around then, right? I mean, that was what we did every freaking day. We went to meetings and we went to effing Denny's. After either Denny's Pompano or Denny's Deerfield. We would argue for hours on which Denny's we were going to go to. That was like the highlight of the day. We're going to Denny's north or south. We going north or south. And I couldn't believe that was my life. I could not. How could this be my life? How could I give up all that I had? Now, granted, I'm judging this guy because he don't have a girlfriend or a car, right? I just lost my house. I had a restraining order on me. I had a lawsuit for assault and battery. I lost the car, right? And I'm in AA, too. But I'm judging him by what I think success is labeled by, right? I'm just a victim of bad breaks and circumstance. You know, that's just all. I'm a victim when I get here. That none of this is my fault. And, you know, if the bitch would just understand. I mean, it just, you know, bad breaks and misunderstandings. That was the story of my life, you know. And so I had a resentment for a while that because I couldn't picture my life being like. I wanted to ask, like, what do you guys do for fun? And I think they were afraid to tell me that Denny's was it. You know, And they, once in a while, we went to ice cream. There was ice cream across the street from the Denny's North. And once in a while, we went and had ice cream, and that was a highlight, you know. And I remember sitting there going, this can't be. You know, I just, I don't think I can do this. And, you know, Sandy Beach, one of the guys that I follow, and I was actually listening to Sandy today. When I work out, I'm a speaker chaser. I'm a speaker chaser. I still chase Sandy. He's not. I know he's not here. I chase Sandy. I still chase Ray O'Keefe. I still chase Garrett M. I still chase Ben T. There's guys that I chased when I got here. Mike L. Dave Todd. I mean, there's Father Bob. You know, some great guy, Zeke, crazy Zeke. You know, I mean, he wasn't that crazy then, but you know, but who knew we were all crazy? Who knew? You know. And so I still, when I'm working out or driving, I slap a CD, and I love listening to people in recovery that are on the page. And Sandy said something really cool. I was listening to him the other day, and he said, you know what happens when you stop drinking? You're sober. That's scary, right? And that's what happened. When I came in here, I stopped drinking, and I was sober. And what you find out is why you drank, right? I mean, you find out why you drank. Because here I am now, I'm a five-year-old again who can't stand life. You know, I'm a teenager again who can't stand life. You know, I can't live like this. And I needed, alcohol was not my problem. I so identify with Bill Wilson's story when the market crashes and everybody's jumping from high rise and commit suicide. And what's Bill say? Fuck that, I went back to the bar, right? Because that was Bill's solution. That was not his problem. Well, I felt the same way. Alcohol was not my problem. Alcohol was my solution. You know? My problem was sober. My problem was living with me. My problem was this inner dialogue that says you're not good enough. You're not tall enough. You know, your nose is too big. Your ears stick out. You know, you're too short. You know, why can't I be that guy? Why can't I be the jock? You know, why can't I be the musician? You know, why can't my hair be long and blonde and wavy like that guy? Why do I have this curly frizzy shit? You know, it's just this dialogue that told me that I was wrong, that everything was wrong about my life. And I felt that. And I felt that. And to me, that's the unmanageability. That was the unmanageability that ran my life up until the time that I found my solution. Yeah. I mean, it's just, I hate it. And I don't know why that is. I mean, I like the first week I'm here. I know some of you haven't heard my story. And you know, we'll talk a little bit about how I got here, a little bit about what it was like. The next 11 weeks, we're going to talk about what happened, you know, but what it was like was, it was not fun being me, you know, I hated being me. I absolutely despised it. I really think that alcohol interrupted my suicide at some point in my life, you know. I mean, when all I could think about was girls, but I was scared to death of them, I knew it was over for me, you know. I mean, it was just like the main goal in life was to get laid, and I can't talk to girls. You know, that's a problem, and is it for a teenager? You know what I mean? That's because if I asked somebody out and they said no, I'd have to kill myself. I couldn't take that kind of rejection. I mean, and I don't know where that comes from. I have no idea whether I was just wired that way from the start. I don't know. I was a five-year-old who threw up on my way to school, literally threw up on my way to school. I was a five-year-old that would not get up in front of the class and read my homework. I will take the incomplete. I will take the F, you know, rather than get up there and possibly embarrass myself. Possibly. Not necessarily, but possibly. And just in case I'm going to embarrass, I'm not going to do it. You know? Which is really makes it a miracle that I'm standing here right now, because you know, not much has changed internally. It's just I have a different power in my life today. I mean, I don't know what does a five-year-old have to be afraid of? I mean, what makes somebody, I don't know. I don't know what that is. You know, there was a lot of violence in my house. My dad was a violent guy. I didn't know till later that he was he's potentially one of us. I can't say that he's one of us, but he sure resembles one of us, you know. But you never know who was walking in that door. You didn't know if my dad was going to walk in that door and say, pack up the car, we're going camping. Or come in and my mom might ask something stupid like, where were you the last 3 days? And all hell would break loose. And he would beat the hell out of my mother in front of us, you know. And that's a picture I'll never forget. You know, that picture I'll never forget. Now, that will cause a slightly nervous disposition in a child, you know, not knowing who's going to walk through that door. And by the way, on our way to camping somebody, sometimes my mom might ask something stupid like, where'd you get this car? And all hell would break loose again, you know. I mean, and I literally remember, I mean, it's so vivid, like it was yesterday, my dad kicking my mother out of the car and driving off, right? And the three of us, there was four later, but the three of us sitting in the back seat, because shit, mom's gone, you know? What are we going to do now, you know? And she'd find a way home. I mean, I'm telling you, he'd take off, you know? That'll create a nervous disposition, and maybe that's probably why I needed a drink. You know, that might have something to do with why I needed a drink, you know? It's not why I'm an alcoholic. You know, and we'll get to that. And I'm an alcoholic because when I really, truly want to stay stopped, I cannot. And once I start, I can't control the amount I take. That's what makes me alcoholic. Why we need a drink and why we're alcoholics are two different deals, you know. And there's a lot of heavy drinkers out there that need drinks, but they're not one of us. You know, they're given good, given sufficient reason and they stop, you know. But I needed a freaking drink. I really did. If I had known what alcohol would do for me at 5 years old, I would have done it at five. You know, I would have been going to school with a bottle in my hand, you know, but I had no idea. And I really lived that, in my mind, I lived that agony. I mean, it really was. It was an internal agony as a child. I just hated my life. And as a teen, I couldn't wait. I mean, all I could think of is getting a car. I mean, I don't know why that was in. All I wanted was a car. I just, you know, my dad left when I was about 6 years old. My mother married another violent drunk, and him and I was hitting my teen years, and him and I started butting heads, and it was getting physical, and I just needed to get out of there. I just felt like that if I had a car and I had some freedom, that I would feel better, right? I mean, if I could just fill the hole with something, and what I need is a car. You know, because I think if I get a job and I get a car, I'll get a girl and then life will be great, you know, because that's how I measured success. That's what I thought success was. I really thought that would be the solution, that the car would lead to the girl, that would lead to happiness and forever after, right? And so at 14 years old, I buy a car. I don't have a license, but I buy a car, right? Rules don't apply to us. You know, we do what we want, right? At 15, I'm almost 16 years old. I drive to Harrisburg. I'm from Pittsburgh originally. I drive to Harrisburg, PA, to get my learner's permit. And I come back from Harrisburg. I pass my driver's test, and I'm out. I'm ready to leave the house. I can't wait to get out of that house and be on my own and be able to do what I want and be my own person, do what I want, find success, find something. And I didn't know that until now, that to find something to fill that freaking hole that's in my soul, you know, and I didn't know that. And what's managing my life is fear. You know, what's running my life is fear. I'm not going to be a success. You know, I'm never going to have a girlfriend. You know, I'm never going to have the right job. You know, and I was a kid that hated school. I didn't like school. I didn't do bad in school. I just didn't like it. You know, and I wasn't going to go to college. I loved working with my hands. I loved the trades, and that was my thing. You know, but the miracle, and I really mean that, the miracle in my life took place. I was got my driver's license, got my car. And I got my cousin Russell found out that I had a car and called me and said, you know, you need to pick us up. We're going to a dance tonight, and we hear you got a car. You know? And I said, I don't dance. And I wasn't. I didn't go to any of the homecomings. I didn't go to any of those proms or any of that kind of stuff. I didn't do the dance thing, you know. And I was the guy that would stand on the wall hoping there was a girl desperate enough to ask me to dance. You know, that was my deal, right? There's got to be somebody hard up enough to ask me to. And that was the only way that was going to happen. I was just not going to do it. And I said, no, I don't dance. And he goes, nah, come. There's going to be a good band there. You can just come and watch the band. And all right. So I pick him up and my buddy Rat. I love telling this story because everybody's got a friend named Rat, right? Rat was a 16-year-old Italian that looked 30, right? And in Pennsylvania, you got to be 21 to buy liquor. You have to go to a state. Anybody from PA? You got to go to a state store or a beer distributor. There's no, like, when I came to Florida and saw booze in a 7-Eleven, I thought I had died and gone to heaven. I couldn't believe it. You could actually fondle the bottles. you could touch them and hug them and look at them. And in state stores, you got to point at them. I'll have one of those or one of those. But Rat was, and by the way, I've never told this story. I don't know what made me think of it on the way over here is that that Rat about 3 years ago died 23 years sober. You know, and we didn't get sober together, but I found that out after he died, and that he was one of us. And but anyways, he goes in and gets a bottle of Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill and a bottle of orange vodka and halfway through that bottle of Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill, I had a spiritual awakening. I mean, there's just no doubt. I mean, I knew a new freedom and a new happiness. I could intuitively know how to handle situations now that used to baffle me. I knew how my experience could benefit others at this point. And I danced with everybody on that dance floor that night. I had the absolute time of my life. We're talking 1973, bell-bottom pants, platform shoes. I got the paisley shirt with the big collar, hair down to my shoulders. I was John Travolta, baby. I was doing the pose. I was staying alive out there. And ladies, I was like your worst nightmare. I was the guy that kept coming around in front of you, you know, like you were trying to dance with your girlfriends, and I just kept coming around, you know, and you're trying to get away from me, but I just kept coming around, man. I danced with everybody in that dance that night. I had the absolute time of my life, and the fear was gone. The inner unmanageability was gone. That internal condition that Mark Houston talks about, another great speaker, I love Mark. He talked about when he referred to that spiritual malady, he referred to it as an internal condition that prevented me from enjoying my life. And it was just, that was gone, that angst. You know what I'm talking about? That anxiety that was just, was gone. You know, and I, the truth is, I went on a 20-year run. I mean, that's the truth. That's really what it was. And I didn't see that until looking back. I mean, we live our life forward. We understand it backwards, you know. But I didn't understand it until I got here, that it was a 20-year run, that I was never going to return to that scared-to-death little child before I picked up that bottle. And pretty much my drug of choice became whatever you had at that point. I didn't even ask what it was half the time. You know, maybe the next day I said, what the was that? you know, ended up in the front yard of somebody. I don't know what the hell, you know. But, I started asking at least what direction we were going. You know, are we going up or down? I just need to prepare, you know. And alcohol is my thing, man. I mean, you know, I heard it put one time, if you really want to determine what your drug of choice is, then, you know, you have one room that you're allowed to enter for the rest of your life. One room you get to pick to enter for the rest of your life, and it's the alcohol room, the opiate room, the benzo room, the cocaine room. You know, which room are you choosing? And that's probably your drug of choice. And I'm choosing the alcohol room. You know, I mean, alcohol did for me what I needed it to do for me. I like the other stuff, but I'm choosing that alcohol room. That's the one I want. And, you know, the inner unmanageability was fixed, but the what we call consequences, alcohol started to manage my life, right? I got a new manager, and I went through the windshield 3 days after that drink. I wrecked 3 more cars that year. I got arrested 3 times that year. I lost my driver's license before my 17th birthday for 5 years, and I only got it back because I moved to Florida and spent a lot of money to get it back. And I got my first felony at 19. You know, and I love Bill's story. It says ominous warnings, which I failed to heed. And that was the truth. Everybody around me was going, dude, this is not working for you. And I'm going, no, this is perfect. You know, this, you know, I'll figure that out, right? That's the alky thinking, right? You know, no, this is fine. I just need to figure that out. You know, I need to like watch these quaaludes and driving. I got to watch that thing right there. You know, that's going to have to come to a stop. You know, the mad dog 2020 and driving, that's going to have to stop. You know, I was thinking about that. You know, I never asked what brand of wines they had. I asked what proof they were, right? You know, I knew that Lancers was 20 proof. I knew that Mad Dog was 20 proof. I knew that Thunderbird was 20 proof. You know, I knew with a proof of it. I didn't know what it tasted like. I ordered it because it was powerful. That's why I ordered it. If those guys saw me pull out that Mad Dog 2020 bottle, they ran. They ran because I went to jail every time I drank it. I don't know what the hell was in that stuff, but it wasn't grapes, I don't think. I, 1978, I had my first son, and in 1979, I got married, which is kind of my pattern. And in 1980, I moved to South Florida. If anybody knows what was going on in 1980 in South Florida, cocaine cowboy, baby. I mean, I'm not going to tell you a drunkalogue, but I am going to tell you part of my story, and my story includes that. And I found a way to drink around the clock and still make it to work. It was a beautiful thing. I mean, it was just amazing. I used to spend $300 to go to work to make 80. You know, it made sense then. It did. It made perfect sense then. I was the number one employee. I will tell you that. I will tell you that. You do an eight ball and go to work, you're like, you're moving, man. You're like, the boss, you say, we need 10 of that son of a bitch. Look at him go, man. You know, if we could just find 10 more of him, we would be successful. You know? You rack up debt doing that, but I'll tell you what, it made sense. It just made, I would stagger into that guy's house and come out of there like a businessman, you know, and ready to go to work, man. Just work another 8 hours and come out of there and start over again. And unfortunately, that and a marriage don't go together well, because I become an absentee father, an absentee husband, and I'm running. That's just a whole different lifestyle, and it was a lifestyle that my ex-wife wasn't willing to go to. And she, you know, got that responsible gene. You know, you had a child, and I don't know how that works. You know, we have a child we need to take. Yeah, I know. That's why I go to work every day. And yeah, but you should come home once in a while. And I don't know how the marriage lasted as long as it did, but it lasted until 1989. And in 1989, she wanted out so bad, and I was adamant about not letting her leave. You know how we are? We're like clingy. You know, like we trap them. We don't marry them. We trap them, you know. And it's... Alky love looks a lot like stalking. I mean, really, if I could have padlocked the doors and just kept her there, I would have. But so you're leaving, but you're not leaving with nothing. I mean, that was my mindset. If you're going to leave, you know, I'm going to make it so difficult for you to leave that you won't want to leave. But she wanted out so bad that she gave up the house, the car. I got custody of my son, and I won. I won. That's what I thought. You know, and I was determined to win. I was determined to make it so difficult to leave that she couldn't. That's Elky shit right there, man. That's just, where does that come from? I mean, that just, you know, I look back at my behavior and how sick it was. I mean, how self-absorbed I was. And here's the rub. She leaves, and I don't know if you were like me, like we would throw them out, but then tell them don't leave. You know, anybody do that? Like, you know, hey, if you don't like it, get them out, you know. And then they'd start for the door and go, wait a minute, you know, where are you going, you know. I mean, I'd do that over and over again, you know. If you don't like it here, go find something better. And then she'd start to go find something better, go, hold on, oh no, I'm so sorry, you know, come back. And, but I would say, it was probably the first time I ever reflected in my life. It was probably the emotional bottom in my life. I was halfway through a bottle of Jose Cuervo 1800 meditating and reflecting on my life and how could it come to this? And I want to tell you what's really sad, and I hate to even admit this, that I was sitting in my bedroom with this bottle, and my 10-year-old son was in the other room, and all I could think about is she's out there having fun, and I'm stuck here. And that's sad. That's a sad state of affair. I had custody of my son. I had the biggest gift that anyone ever could be given, and I thought I got screwed. How did I get here? You know, how am I gonna continue my lifestyle when I've got this 10-year-old to take care of? And I was just self-absorbed. I was so pissed off that she was having a good time and that someone else could be happy without me. And with my 10-year-old in the other room, I tried to commit suicide. And it sickens me to even reflect on that I could be that selfish and that self-absorbed and not even consider the impact that would have had on my son, let alone my mother, you know, the people who truly did love me. All I could feel was what I feel, right? All we feel is what we feel, and what we feel is the most important thing on the planet at that particular moment. And And when we're in that mode, no matter what anybody says, all we hear is Charlie Brown's teacher, right? Wah, 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 wah. It's like when you first come in here and people are trying to tell you what you need to do, and that's what you hear. Wah, 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 wah. You know, I can't hear it. I can't get past what I feel. And you know, I convinced her to come back. I convinced her that things would be different. I made the promises that we make. You know, that, and I never promised that I would stop drinking. I did promise that I would only drink on weekends and I would never do another drug, that I was done with the drug scene. And that's true. I was 2 years clean when I got into the rooms of AA. I often thought about going to another fellowship and gaining 2 years. Would that be cool? Like, I could be 30 if I went to NA. Yeah. Nah. But I never touched another drug since then. I've been actually clean 30 years, and but I couldn't stay stopped, and the book speaks to that. I just could not stand the way I felt when I wasn't drinking. I could not do life sober. As Sandy said, when you stop drinking, you're sober, and now you know why you drank. And I was only going to drink on weekends. You know when I made it to Wednesday, I white knuckled it until Wednesday. And then I become the secret drinker. Like, we're so secret, you know, when we stagger in at 2 a.m, you know, where were you working? Yeah. I mean, I couldn't do it. I mean, I was my buddy Jimmy D, who I'll talk about later, my buddy Jimmy D and I would make a pact with each other that whoever, we'd bet money that whoever was going to fall short first would have to pay. And we'd be questioning each other, like, did you drink? No, did you? You know, and neither one of us could make it till Saturday, you know. And I hit a physical bottom. It took me 2 years to hit a physical bottom with alcohol, and started losing control of bodily functions, waking up in my own urine. I got shut off at Brady's Lounge. I mean, in North Lauderdale. I mean, it's just for urinating, and I mean, nobody, they have no sense of humor whatsoever, you know. And I don't even know what I said. I don't even know what she said. All I know is that she said something to me when I got home, and I knocked my wife down in front of my two kids. I had another child in those 2 years, and we had another child. And I gave my two boys the same picture I had of my father knocking my mother down, and I hated my father for that. And I did the same. I became him. I became my mentor. Right? I became that guy that I couldn't. It's funny how that happens, right? How you attract who you hate. You become who you hate. I mean, it's just like if you really hate your father, you end up with somebody just like him, you know? Or you really hate your mother, you seem to marry somebody just like them. I don't know how that happens, but it's one of those weird paradoxes, man. And It was the beginning of the beginning of the end, however you want to leave it. I mean, I love Clancy's talk. It's a disease of perception, however you perceive that. Was I blessed that day or screwed that day? I mean, I surely thought I got screwed. The police came. I got arrested. I got a restraining order. Got charged. She got the house. She got custody of my son. I lost custody of the son. And I left there, went to a Days Inn. It was a commercial on 441, the southeast corner. I'll never forget. It's now La Quinta at 441 and Commercial. And I spent 3 weeks in that hotel room. And I want to tell you something. If alcohol still worked, I would not be here. I don't give a shit what the consequences were. I don't care. You know, I gave up custody of my son. I gave up a marriage. Actually, 2 shots at that same marriage, right? I've given up jobs because I wasn't going to stop. There was nothing that was going to take that solution away from me. And if it still worked, I'd still be doing it. I don't care. We don't get stopped by consequences. We're just not those people. You know, something tragic has to happen to get our attention. And really what had to happen for me was alcohol had to stop working. It had to stop treating the internal condition. It had to stop treating the fear and the anxiety. It had to stop giving me absolution for my behavior. My former sponsor, Garrett M., used to always say alcohol would give me permission to satisfy my instinctual drives and then would give me absolution afterwards. and it stopped giving me absolution. I couldn't get it out of the bottle anymore. And I'm 3 weeks in that hotel room drinking to pass out, to get up to drink, to pass out, to get up to drink, to pass out, and I'm not getting any relief. And I hit a wall. I hit that moment where I couldn't stand the way I felt anymore, and I can't stop. I can't stop drinking. And I made a phone call. And my sister was in Alcoholics Anonymous. She had been in AA for a while. I never talked to her about AA. I never asked her about AA. Nobody ever told me I should go to AA. I didn't know anything about it. Yeah. And I, for some reason, I called her and said, I need help. And she picked me up, took me to my first AA meeting. It was at the Fifth Chapter Club in Lighthouse Point, March 26, 1991. And at the end of that, I don't even know what guy. I think it was a big book meeting. I don't even know. We were talking about that on the way over here. I don't remember anything. My first few weeks in AA. I don't remember any of the meetings. I don't remember what was going on there. All I remember is not wanting to be there, but knowing I needed to be there. You know, I just that kind of thing. Like I had nowhere else to go. You know, I'm staying in the back room of my mother's house, and I'm in AA, and I don't know where else to go. And thank God, I don't have anywhere else to go. And the guy who was chairing the meeting looked like Papa Smurf. Found out later his name was Lee May. And Lee, at the end of the meeting, asked if there was anybody who wanted to start a new way of life and pick up a white chip. And I picked up a white chip that night. It's the only white chip I've ever picked up. And I don't know if he asked that question in any other way if I get up out of my chair. I don't know. Was you ready to surrender? No. I got shit to get back. You know, are you ready to give up the fight? Hell no. You know, I'm not done fighting. I'm still a victim of bad breaks and circumstances here. I got stuff to get back, you know. But he asked if there anybody wanted to start a new way of life, and I surely wanted a new way of life. And that was my last drink. That was the last time I ever picked up a drink. Now, like I said, I didn't get better. I got worse coming here. I was raging. I was trying to talk her into letting me back in. You know how we are, you know. Now that I know the solution, you know, I called her up. I said, look, figured out what the problem is. It's this booze stuff. Yeah, like nobody knew, you know. I got breaking news here, you know. I think I'm one of them alcoholics. You know, I'm going to this AAA thing, And I think I'm one of them. I think I belong here. So now that I know what my problem is, I know I just don't drink. I'm an alcoholic, okay? If that's what you want, I'm an alcoholic, okay? And she said, I mean, without skipping a beat, no, you're an asshole, you know, and hung up the phone. And she was right. She was right. I had no idea that, and we find that out later, that alcohol is but a symptom, that it's my assholiness that's the real program, you know? If I could just work on that assholiness, I would have better relationships with people and therefore maybe not need a drink. You know? But I suffered for 3 months in this program from untreated alcoholism. And like I said, I don't know if I was just hanging out with the wrong people. I mean, I thank God for the fellowship. I mean, they did keep me busy enough to, I mean, you know, they were saying do a 90 and 90. I was a 270 and 90 guy. You know, I was doing 3-4 meetings a day. It was ABCs back then, ashtrays, brooms, and chairs, right? And I was ashtray guy, garbage guy, just make me whatever guy, because at 11 o'clock, I got nowhere else to go, so I'll clean up, I'll do the garbage, I'll do whatever you want to do. I was living in the Fifth Chapter Club, literally. I mean, I was there, when I wasn't working, I was at the Fifth Chapter, you know, and that was just a deal, or the 101, or wherever, the Pompano Beach Group. You know, I was at some clubhouse somewhere hanging out, and I don't, the Fifth Chapter Club, by the way, was a really cool place, because they had, Frank had a clubhouse on one side and a meeting room on the other side. Like, if you didn't want to hear that crap over there in the meeting room, you could go talk about them in the clubhouse, you know, so you could hang out there and not have to listen to that crap they were talking about in there, that not drinking thing. And I picked up my 90-day chip, my red chip, at the 10 p.m. meeting at the Fifth Chapter Club, and I was suicidal again. So, and I know you don't want to call that, so undrunk, without liquor in my body. You know, we call it sober. You know, we call it abstinent, you know. But I was at the same place 90 days sober as I was in that hotel room, only there was no liquor involved. You know, that I, and here's what it was. I can't live like this for one more freaking second. And oh yeah, I can't drink. What's the difference? You know, I can't live like this for one more freaking second. And oh yeah, I can't stop. You know, it's the same place. And I'm contemplating suicide again. You know, I can't do this. I don't know what's going on here, but it ain't for me. And I let you guys all know that at my little speech at my red chip pickup. You know, what a bunch of losers you are, and some kind of 12-step junkies that it's going on. I don't know what's going on here, some kind of cult, you know, that's going on here, that I feel like I'm stuck in a bad Saturday Night Live skit or something, you know, like I want to share, you know. And if one more person hugs me, I'm going to punch them. I'm just going to. And today I'm a hugger. I mean, you guys know me, I'm a hugger, but I'm telling you, I couldn't stand it. Just get. Don't touch me, you know. And I left that meeting, and I was standing out. And there's two stories. You know, it's like AA history, right? AA history up until 1939 is an oral history, right? So you get different stories, right? Like the way Bill tells the story, him and Ebby, maybe we'll get to that somewhere down the road. But the way Bill tells that story and the way Ebby tells that story are two totally different stories, right? But they're both true, right? And the way I tell this story and the way Brian H. tells this story, two different stories, but they're both true, right? It's just our perception of what took place. It's an oral history. It's how I remember it. I remember standing by the Fifth Chapter Club, by the railing, and I'm thinking it ain't high enough, you know, to kill myself off of. And Brian approaches me and says, you know, there's a program here. And I said, yeah, I've been coming for 90 days. He goes, no, you've been visiting the fellowship for 90 days. There's a program here. You know, it's called the Big Book. Big Book is the program. You know, welcome to the fellowship. Would you like to hear the Big Book? Now, Brian tells that story that he had just been to a Big Book seminar, a Joe Charlie Big Book seminar. He's on fire with the Big Book. My sister sees him and says, see that guy? That's my brother. You need to go help my brother. And Brian wants to see if this Big Book seminar shit works. And he approaches me with some new knowledge. And he tells a story like he was going through the steps while he was taking me through the steps. And you know, I see it like a godsend. I see it like, oh my God, an angel, right? And we get into his little mazda behind the back of the Fifth Chapter Club, and he reads the doctor's opinion to me. And I don't know where you were hiding that, but there's some real pertinent information right there. You know, somebody finally told me why I couldn't stay stopped and why I couldn't control my drinking once I started. I didn't know what I didn't know. And I resented the fact that I had been into a lot of meetings. I had never heard the doctor's opinion. I had never heard obsession of the mind and allergy of the body discussed in any of the meetings that I was in. Now, maybe I was in the wrong meetings. You know, maybe I was hanging out with the wrong crowd. I don't know. You know, but I was a little pissed off when I found that out. You know, you can't stop because you suffer from a mind that believes a lie just before you pick up a drink. Right? It tells you it's okay to drink. And the body that ensures that it is not, that once you put a drink in you, you suffer from something called a physical craving for more, that your body reacts differently than 9 out of 10 drinkers. You're the one. You know, you have an allergy, an abnormal reaction to alcohol. You know? But that's not the problem. The problem, if I never picked up a drink, I would never suffer from the allergy. The problem is that my mind keeps telling me that it's going to be okay because my mind can only see what alcohol is going to do for me, and completely blocks out what it's going to do to me, you know. And I never knew why I would call home. I would call and look, start dinner. I'm on my way, and I would go to the pick and pack, and I'd go through the drive-through and grab one tall Budweiser for the ride. Disguise it like we do in a brown paper bag, like nobody knows what's in there, you know. We're smart, these Elkies. Put the wine bottle in a bag; nobody will know, you know. And I'd never made it home. Never. I mean, it became an ongoing joke. Like, yeah, I'll see you tomorrow. You know, I meant it, though. When I called, when I told my son I was going to be at his football game Friday night, I meant that with all my heart. But I would go pick up a beer, and then I would say, look, well, the game's not till 8 o'clock. Let me say hi to the fellows at the body shop real quick. And I'd say hi to them, and maybe they'd have a couple of beers, and maybe they'd have something else going on there, too. And the next thing I know, it's 2, 3, 4 in the morning. And I missed the football game. And my son would say stuff. I love that line in Dr. Pinion, frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. My son would say something, Dad, please, You said you'd be there last week. You sure you're going to make it this week? You know, yeah. I'll definitely be there. And I never made it. You know, I didn't come home on Christmas Eve. One Christmas Eve, I didn't come home. I called. I meant to. We're going to put some stuff together. I'm on my way. Yeah. And I didn't go. I didn't make it. And you know what I had? You know all I had? When she said, and this, did anybody ever hear this? How could you? Right? I heard that a lot. Like, how could you? And all I had was, I don't know. I didn't know. I didn't want to say, well, I changed my mind. I mean, who would do that? Who would say they're on their way home on Christmas Eve and change their mind? You know, I didn't know until that night. Somebody finally explained to me what my problem was. You know, the book describes it so perfectly. Like, and that's my whole life, restless, irritable, and discontent. Right? Yeah, that's me. That's my life without booze. You know? And then this ease and comfort, it comes at once. At three. That's what I... At one or two, three. Right? And then boom. I'm off to the races, you know. And I'd come out of that just like the book says. I'm so sorry. Look, I'm done. No, I mean it this time. No, seriously. Unpack. Yeah. Your Honor, seriously. You let me out of here this time. You'll never, ever see me again. And that's a true story. I got arrested for that felony that I was talking about. That I got set up, by the way. But that... I was profiled, damn it. You know, I was the only white guy in the neighborhood. Profiling's wrong. First time ever in county. Now, granted, I look like a miniature John Travolta, right? Like at 125 pounds, you know. And I look like a date in the Allegheny County Jail. And the next morning, I'm serious. I'm crying. I'm scared to death. I've never been so scared in my life. And I swear to this judge that if he R's me, you'll never see me again. I mean, that's just, I swear to God. I swear on my mother. And you know, I was drunk before I got home. And you guys understand that. There was just too much pressure. Right? Right? I mean, you get it. Like, you leave there and you go, shit, I need an attorney. When's that court date? You know, crap, I don't have that kind of money. You know? I just need to take the edge off. I need to just calm down, right? And boom, I'm off to the races again. Without a thought. I love Bill Wilson in the documentary. He says something really cool when he talks about that business opportunity. It's a story in itself. Maybe we'll get to it somewhere down the road. But Bill describes it like this, that it was as if a black curtain came down between me and the truth. And that's exactly what took place to me, right? Obsession of the mind, the inability to see the truth. In favor of what it's going to do for me, because I can't stand the way I feel. I got to fill that hole with something. And alcohol did the trick. Yeah. Now the trick becomes, how do I live without it? You know, that was the first step for me. That was the, I'm powerless over alcohol. That was my first step right there. I knew after sitting with Brian that I was powerless over alcohol, and I've been chasing this ever since. All somebody had to do was describe to me what my problem was. That was the Bill Wilson's awakening moment with Dr. Silkworth. You know, that people like us are different. You know, I personally caught the genetic bullet. I believe. You know, I come from a long line of Irish drunks, man. I always say, thank God my dad married an Italian or we would have never eaten, you know, because the Irish side did not give a shit about food, man. It was Bushmills whiskey. That was the deal, you know. And, you know, both my grandfathers are dead from this illness. My grandmother on the Irish side, dead from this illness. My dad had four brothers and two sisters. He has one sister alive today who doesn't drink. My dad drinks a half a fifth of vodka to go to sleep every night, you know. He says it's potato vodka. I'm not sure what that means. I think he thinks it's a vegetable. I don't know. It's good for you, you know. I got my younger sister. My sister, who's 2 years younger than me, she 12-stepped me. She has 2 years less sober than I do. My brother, it skipped. Does anybody have somebody in his family like that? Have a normie? Like, everybody's a drunk, and then there's this normie that goes fishing with a six-pack and brings 5.5 beers back. You know, like, and then dumps the warm one out on the way in, like he's an alcohol abuser. You know, He's that guy. He could take it or leave it. He doesn't ask if there's going to be liquor at the party when he's coming over. You know, should I bring my own? He doesn't ask that question. He doesn't care. You know? My baby sister died of an overdose 10 years ago. You know, my mother had 3 out of the 4 of us she had to deal with, you know, that were alcoholics and addicts. You know, God bless her. You know. I want to thank you guys for having me here. It's really good to be here. I love this room. I love the energy here. Like I say, it's a lot like speaking to the choir because I know you guys are on the same page that I'm on. And I'm really grateful that you guys allowed me to come here and share my experience. So we'll see you next week. We'll talk more about it. Thanks, buddy. Appreciate it.
Let's go ahead and thank Pat again. Now it's time to introduce the secretary, and our alcoholic secretary for tonight is Ryan.
Shall be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. The baskets are now going around. And as the baskets are going around, I've asked Megan to read the recovered statement, reread this notice, to explain why many people in this group identify as recovered rather than recovering, and what it exactly means to be a recovered alcoholic.
I'm Megan, alcoholic. Recovered. We are not cured of alcoholism. Recovered but not cured. That presents a conflict to some alcoholics. If we were cured, we would be able to drink responsibly. No, we are not cured. The allergic reaction to alcohol will remain with us for our lifetime. But we have been restored to sanity. That was the problem. The main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in the body. We are now sane where alcohol is concerned. Consequently, we have recovered.
...1940s-style Big Book sponsorship from forward to the second edition of Alcoholics Anonymous. Of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, 50% got sober at once and remained that way, 25% sobered up after some relapses, and among the remainder, those who stayed on with AA showed improvement. What we've seen, felt, come to believe, and experience is that God has not changed over time, and neither should the sacred approach back to his loving arms. The statistics above suggest a 75% success rate. Can I see a show of hands of recovered alcoholics? Is there anyone here that needs a sponsor? If you could just raise your hand. No. All right, well, if you're too shy to raise your hand, just see any of the people that just had theirs up. Please join us Monday nights for the Big Book Study meeting where the book comes alive. Fellowship starts at 6:30, and the Big Book Study starts at 7:15. And we have CDs, mugs, large print big books, little red books, big book dictionaries for sale on the back table. So if you're interested in any of that, just see one of the home group members. And we meet every Thursday starting promptly at 7:15. And we ask that you be courteous and ready to begin at the sound of the bells. And we have announcements. Broward County Intergroup, you know, you can get like literature if you have that hard to shop for a sponsor with Christmas coming up. You can get everything here. There's office hours and information up there. If you're looking for volunteer opportunities, there's a couple coming up Saturday, October 16th. It's AA's Got Talents coming up. That's always fun. Then Gratitude Dinner, Sunday, October 27th. The Broward County Institutions Committee, this is just a list of their monthly meetings. And the next one that's coming up is, okay, never mind. And then Gratitude Dinner Planning Meeting is Sunday, October 27th. We just talked about that one, Coral Ridge Presbyterian Church. General Service District 9 Quarterly Area Assembly Host Committee. That's over. And this Saturday coming up, the 12th, is the Early Timers Meeting. There's going to be 3 speakers with 25 or more years of recovery. Sounds pretty good. And then that's this meeting. We meet every Thursday starting promptly at 7:15. We ask that you be ready to begin at the sound of the bells. And also, if you smoke or vape, they have the Boy Scouts upstairs. So they're trying to quit right now. So if you could just make your way down to the end here where the buckets are set up, that'd be great. So thank you, and I'll see you next week.
I'd like to... I have the secretary respond. We have tonight's session and all the past speaker podcasts online free at alcoholicsandgod.org. I'd like to invite everyone to our Monday night big book study. And those whom would like to thank tonight's speaker, please line up down the center aisle. And now let's close with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father.
I am desperately in need of restoration. Yeah, and I am ready for you to take me higher. Yeah, the only thing that I can do is I'm praying, 'cause on my own I just can't get it right. It doesn't matter how hard I try, but with you I become a much stronger man. Getting on my knees puts me back on my feet again. Load is heavy, too much to keep. These possessions that I have amount to nothing at all, and I am willing to hand over every one of them, 'cause they won't profit me anything. It doesn't matter how hard
sounds, and oh, when you're smiling, when you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you, baby. Yes, when you're laughing, when you're laughing, yes, the sun comes shining through. But when you're crying, you bring on the rain. So stop your sighing, baby, and be happy again. Yes, and keep on smiling. Keep on smiling, baby. And I hope
everywhere I go, I'm gonna let it shine. shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine, shine, shine. Let it shine. Out in the dark.
Michael Chase, here's that song you've been asking me for a million years. I finally pulled it out the corners of my mind, and here you go. Fog is lifted. See the light, count my blessings when I go to sleep at night, and I dream now. Fear has left me and I'm standing tall. A pile of bricks now lies where once there stood a wall that I hid behind. For all this time, sometimes it takes a burning bush or a great white light to set you right. Well, my eyes don't cry now, my mouth is dry. Pity party's over, the guest of honor has arrived, and he's almost up. The first time in my life, they're green now, growing vines. They twist and turn each way, flowers blooming all the time outside my door. Never before I had to change everything to realize that today is the best day of my life. This broken man had traveled far and wide through the great divide, through his own heart, yeah. Well, I have a life today when it give away and it's just about to start. So I face each day brand new way, show up and plug in my guitar, and I play my songs, and people sing along, and stomp their feet and raise their arms, and here in this moment that we share, nothing could compare. Lessons when I go to sleep at night, and I dream now. Yeah, I dream now, and everything's all right.
Oh, man. Going on 10 years old, that song is. God bless. I love you, Mike Chase. Bye.
This one, don't you? Got one man that just won't say.